Besides, she said, how do you know he's not guilty? Siegel returned to the albums of crime scene and autopsy photographs. He turned to a picture of Kimberly, a picture that showed the fracture of her skull and the piece of cheekbone protruding through the skin of her face. That was his flesh and blood, Helena. What kind of father could do that to his own flesh and blood? Somebody on drugs could do something like that. Not acid, maybe speed. Did they do blood tests on him right away? Yes, Helena, they did blood tests. There were no drugs. There was no alcohol. Has he been given psychiatric evaluation and everything? Yes, Helena, he has been given all of that. Siegel flipped to a picture of Colette. Look at his wife, Helena. Look at this picture. Her jaw was broken. Both of her arms were broken. Her skull was fractured right down the middle. She was stabbed with a knife, with an ice pick, dozens of times. Helena, that was the work of a repulsive, crazy person. Dr. McDonald is a normal, decent human being. Even the army psychiatrists who examined him agreed to that. Siegel turned to a picture of Kristen, a colored picture, taken before the body had been removed from the bed. The bright red of her blood filled the room. Only somebody crazy or whacked out on drugs could have done something like that, Stokely said. I don't know what anybody else is capable of, but I know I'm not capable of that. Helena, no one is asking you to say that you did that. You will not be touched, I promise you. You will not be indicted, ever. All you have to say is you were there, holding the candle, saying acid is groovy. You don't remember hurting anybody. Then you ran out the back door. He turned to another picture of Kimberly. Helena, help us end it. I beg of you. Look at this child's face. For God's sake. To accuse the father of these babies of having done that to them. Helena, look at this. Look at this one. Smashed with a club. Come on, Helena. How much longer will that man have to sit there, accused of something so monstrous? You have it in your power, Helena, to end it. Right now. Otherwise, Helena, I guarantee you, I'm going to take you into court. If I could remember, she told him, I would say. Siegel stepped into an adjacent room where his other witnesses had been waiting. One by one, like the ghosts of Christmas past, he brought them in to confront her with the things she had said to them years before. Beasley, Gaddis, Zilieu, Underhill, the polygraph man, whose name was Brizantine, and finally her ex-neighbor, Posey. None of it mattered. She said hello. She said, nice to see you. How have you been? But whenever they asked her about the McDonald case, she said, I don't remember any of that. One by one, the witnesses trooped out of the room. Siegel was admitting defeat. There would be no dramatic announcement. There would be no news bulletins on TV. No eight-column headlines across page one. There would just be a truculent, uncommunicative, apathetic witness, 30 pounds overweight and looking far less menacing than pathetic, telling the jury she didn't remember a thing. Now, too late, Bernie Siegel realized he would have been better off if she'd never been found. Much easier to have conjured up the image of a drug-crazed and murderous hippie from the distant and dangerous past and to have the jury seize upon that as an explanation than to present them with this burned-out woman and expect them to believe that she had ever stood over a couch on which Jeffrey McDonald had been sleeping and had held a candle beneath his face while chanting, acid is groovy, kill the pigs, acid and rain. Siegel left her in the company of her fiancé, the barefoot and bedraggled Ernest Davis, while he went to inform the judge that he had completed his witness interview and that he was prepared for the trial to resume. It was now lunchtime. Helena Stokely had been given a bologna sandwich. She sat quietly, placidly, chewing her food and slowly turning the pages of the crime scene and autopsy photo albums as if she were browsing through a movie magazine. On the witness stand, under oath, Helena Stokely denied that she had ever been found by a psychiatrist to be mentally ill, or that she had ever been committed to a mental institution. This was, of course, untrue. She had been a psychiatric patient at the University of North Carolina Medical Center in the spring of 1971 and had been diagnosed as a paranoid schizophrenic, subject to delusions and hallucinations. In describing her educational background, Stokely said she had attended Aquinas Junior College in Nashville during 1971 and 1972 and had studied police science there. In 1974, she said, she had taken a six-month operating room technician's course at a Fayetteville hospital. In 1975, at Daytona Beach Junior College, she said, she had taken nursing courses. She then described the extent of her narcotics addiction during the early months of 1970. She had been injecting heroin and liquid opium intravenously 6 to 7 times per day. She had also smoked marijuana and hashish on a daily basis, had consumed LSD almost daily, and mescaline about twice a week, in addition to using barbiturates and angel dust. On Monday, February 16, 1970, she had followed her usual pattern of drug consumption, topping it off with the tablet of mescaline given to her in her driveway by a soldier from Fort Bragg named Greg. She recalled re-entering her apartment after having consumed the mescaline, but said she remembered nothing after that until her return to the apartment at about 4:30 or 5 a.m. in a blue car with 2 or 3 soldiers from Fort Bragg. She said she could recall neither the owner of the car nor any of the other passengers. She said she did not recall ever telling anyone that she thought she might have been involved in the McDonald murders, only that she could not remember where she had been during the time that the murders had taken place. She added, "All I said to the CID whenever I talked to them was I didn't know where I was at that time." This was by no means the startling testimony for which Bernie Siegel had been hoping. It seemed, in fact, actively harmful to his case. Siegel lost further ground when, on cross-examination, Jim Blackburn extracted from Stokely the remark that she had worn her blonde wig infrequently and that she had not been wearing it on the night of Monday, February 16th, because Greg, who had given her the mescaline, did not like it. She also said she had never been inside 544 Castle Drive and that she had never seen Jeffrey McDonald until that very morning when she had entered the courtroom to testify. As Blackburn's cross-examination continued, Stokely came to seem more like the star witness for the prosecution than for the defense. "To your own knowledge," he asked her quietly, "did you participate in the killings of the McDonald family?" "No, sir." "How do you feel toward children?"
"I love children."
"Of your own personal knowledge, did you kill Colette McDonald?"
"No, sir."
"How about Kristen?"
"No, sir."
"How about Kimberly?"
"No, sir."
"Did you try to kill Dr. McDonald?"
"No, sir."
"Do you know who did?"
"No, sir."
"Do you recall ever being in the McDonald apartment carrying a candle?"
"No, sir."
She also said that the night of February 16th to 17th, 1970, had been by no means either the first or the last night on which she could not recall her whereabouts or activities. Given the level of narcotics she had been consuming at the time, this remark seemed her most clearly credible statement of the day. Flustered and frustrated, Bernie Siegel knew that the jury would have to hear, as soon as possible, for those to whom Helena Stokely had told a different tale. It was time for the parade of the Stokely witnesses, a last, desperate attempt to reincarnate the spirit of evil hippies. The prosecution, however, had no intention of standing idly by, mere spectators at such a parade. They, in fact, sought to have the marching orders countermanded. In a criminal trial, when a witness is called to testify, he is, in general, permitted to speak only of what he did or had done to him directly, or of what he personally observed. Were Helena Stokely to have told the jury that she remembered standing over the couch in the living room of 544 Castle Drive holding a candle, there might have been some question about how much weight the jury would have been inclined to give her testimony, but no dispute whatsoever regarding her right to deliver it. whether it was equally proper for police officers Beasley or Gaddis or polygraph operator Brizentine or laundryman Posey or ex-Nashville neighbors Zilieu and Underhill to relate what Stokely had told them was a somewhat more complicated question. Rule 804b(3) of the Federal Rules of Evidence, which govern procedures in federal court, says, "A statement tending to expose the declarant to criminal liability and offered to exculpate the accused is not admissible unless corroborating circumstances clearly indicate the trustworthiness of the statement." Out of the hearing of the jury, Judge Dupree heard the six Stokely witnesses describe what she had told them concerning her possible involvement. Having already heard Stokely say she had no recollections of having participated in the murders, he had now to decide whether the jury should hear statements also from those to whom she had been less unequivocal. Understandably, the prosecution thought such hearsay evidence ought not to be admitted. Even more understandably, Bernie Siegel believed the statements of these witnesses to be crucial to his defense. At the Kappa Alpha House, in lighthearted moments, he would hand out pens that said, "Your criminal lawyer, a reasonable doubt at a price that's right." And it was reasonable doubt, not absolute proof of innocence, for which he was striving now. In conference with Judge Dupree, Brian Murtaugh said that the statements of the Stokely witnesses, because of their inherent lack of credibility, and because they were hearsay, ought not to be deemed admissible. "We have no physical evidence whatsoever to tie her to the crime scene," Murtaugh said. "You know, you say, 'Well, why do you think you were there?' And she says, 'Because I think I was there.' You know, you go around in circles on that." Bernie Siegel was reaching new heights of indignation. "The fact that the government might want to attack her statement," he told Judge Dupree, "does not deny the defendant the right to introduce it. If it was the United States prosecuting someone for murder, and it had these kinds of statements and so-called admissions by the defendant, would the court for a moment hesitate to let the government introduce it? I find it difficult to believe that any court would hesitate to let the government put it in. The fact that someone is crying and weeping when they are talking about a murder that is horrendous does not make it inadmissible. The fact that later on they say, 'I would like to pull it back and withdraw it,' can't affect admissibility. It goes to weight. That is the issue. We want everything that she said to come out. The fact that she both admits and denies, in my judgment and my experience, has never precluded a confession or admission from being put into evidence. Many a defendant has said, you know, to the police officers while being taken to the station, 'Yeah, I was involved.' Then he gets to the station and they get a formal statement. 'Oh no, I will not admit that on paper,' the defendant screams. 'You cannot let that thing in. I mean, I said I didn't do it.' The court says, 'It's for the jury to decide which statements are admissible.' Why is the defendant here now being told that after he has done the job that should have been done by somebody else, he can't offer the evidence? It just seems to me that we've established beyond any reasonable argument the right to put this forward." Responding, Brian Murtaugh once again quoted that portion of Federal Rule 804b(3), which pertained to trustworthiness of the statements. "Your Honor," he said, "first of all, Ms. Stokely's statements are not clearly admissions of guilt. If anything, what they are is what has been brought out on direct and cross-examination, that the woman doesn't know where she was that night, that she was being constantly interrogated by the police, and that she began to have fears about not being able to account for where she was. And these statements cannot be taken out of that context, and out of the context that the woman has been a drug addict, has had hepatitis, has been incoherent, and, to use the description of one of the witnesses, hysterical. So it seems to me that these statements are not trustworthy, and they certainly are being offered to exculpate the accused." Without commenting on whether or not her testimony at trial had seemed believable, Judge Dupree said, "I think her incompetency, at the time she made at least some of the statements attributed to her, has been more than adequately established." "Your Honor," Siegel said, "I dare to disagree. As a matter of fact, there is a certain internal consistency that always has impressed me about what she has said. Now, while I truthfully do not think there is any evidence that Helena Stokely inflicted an injury, there is clearly evidence in my mind from all these witnesses that she carried a candle and was present. Brian Murtaugh would not budge. Your Honor, he said, we are talking about whether a reasonable person making these statements at the time would so appreciate the gravity of the statements that they wouldn't make them unless they meant them. I don't think we have that in this case. What we are talking about here is somebody who is hysterical, perhaps hallucinating. Under those conditions, she makes various statements. Now, those statements are never of an unequivocal nature. It can all be drawn back to her lack of an alibi and the fact that she is constantly being interviewed, picked up, hassled by the police, and having to account for her whereabouts. I think you can't take it out of that context. And I still think, Judge, that the issue here is that the rule mandates that the statements should not be admitted unless there are corroborative circumstances which clearly indicate their trustworthiness. And I just don't see how Mr. Siegel can argue that these various statements which are all over the lot are trustworthy or unequivocal. Your Honor, Siegel replied, we are talking about the denial of the right of a defendant to show that there is evidence that could raise a reasonable doubt on his behalf, because it tends to show the involvement of someone else. Remember, that is all his burden is. And I think the fact that a great range of witnesses coming from every side, police officers, people who do not know this person, people who wanted to help the person, this broad range of people coming forward to say that she has made statements which have the tendency to involve her in the crime are statements that deserve to be heard by the jury. And as my last observation, Your Honor, I do say that these crimes were not committed by reasonable people. These acts are unreasonable. These acts are so consistent with the kind of culture, the kind of persons that Ms. Stokely was involved with, that they in themselves tend to be corroborative. I think we have a tendency, in our own sanity, to lose sight of the fact that we are dealing with, truly, acts of monstrous insanity. Your Honor, said Brian Murtaugh, they've had Helena Stokely herself on the stand for the better part of the day. I think she was more than cooperative with both sides. The basic issue here is that the defendant has not been prejudiced by the exclusion of Helena Stokely's testimony. She was asked point blank on the stand the $64 question about whether she was there or whether she did it. I think we have more than satisfied constitutional requirements in that regard. These further statements are not her statements. They are the statements of other witnesses, and I do not believe they meet the applicable standard of trustworthiness as specified in 804b3. It was 4 o'clock on Friday afternoon, the last hour of the last day of the fifth week of the trial. Franklin T. Dupree said, the court will rule on this motion Monday morning at 10 a.m. Take a recess until that hour, please. Helena Stokely spent the weekend in Raleigh, Bernie Siegel still hoping that he might be able to turn her presence to advantage. Using Jeffrey McDonald's money, he obtained a room for her and her fiancé at a motel called The Journey's End. On Sunday morning, Siegel received a phone call from the manager of the motel. She said that someone had just tried to drown Helena Stokely in the swimming pool. Siegel immediately dispatched a female assistant, a San Francisco attorney named Wendy Rauder, to the scene. Rauder was told that it had been Stokely's fiancé, Ernie Davis, who had been holding her head underwater in the pool. In addition to her broken arm, Stokely, by Sunday morning, had a swollen and blackened eye where it appeared that someone had punched her. She told Rauder that this had occurred the day before when she had stepped into a hallway to buy a can of soda from a machine and a complete stranger had walked up to her and struck her. Rauder, concerned that Ernie Davis, perhaps, was not reacting well to recent stresses, and fearing that he might have been the cause of the black eye as well as the drowning attempt, persuaded him to step into the motel corridor while she spoke privately to Stokely for a moment. Helena, do you want him to leave? Rauder asked. Yes, Stokely said. I want him to go. She immediately began placing his clothes and personal belongings in a suitcase, adding as well all the motel ashtrays she could find. Red Underhill had accompanied Router to the journey's end and was prepared to see Davis to the bus terminal and to give him $20 of Jeffrey McDonald's money for a one-way ticket out of town. Will you be all right? Router asked. Or would you like somebody to stay with you? Stokely said she would prefer to have a companion. How about you? She asked Router. Could you stay? Router agreed to spend at least the afternoon with Helena Stokely, but left the room briefly to permit Stokely to inform her fiancé privately that his presence in Raleigh was no longer desired. 10 minutes later, the door swung open, and Davis, bare-chested and carrying the suitcase, ran down the hall. Re-entering the room, Router and Red Underhill found Stokely in the bathroom, bleeding profusely from the nose. She said no, Davis had not hit her, she had simply walked into a door. With Stokely holding towels to her nose and tilting her head back, in an attempt to get the bleeding to stop, Wendy Router spent the afternoon with her in her motel room. As the bleeding gradually subsided, Stokely and Router began to talk. It was mostly small talk. Stokely described to Router how she had had, at one time, a magnificent singing voice, and how, had it not been for the stroke she had suffered, she might have had a career in opera. Eventually, there came a lull in the conversation. Then Stokely said, "I still think I could have been there that night." "What makes you think so?" Router asked. "I don't know." There was another pause. Then Stokely said, That rocking horse in Kristen's room. Seeing the toy horse depicted in one of the crime scene photographs had brought back to Stokely a flash of memory, of imagination, in which she had been sitting on the horse, trying to ride it, but had been unable to, because the wheels were broken and it wouldn't roll. The rocking horse, as it happened, had been on runners, not wheels. Then, after another pause, Stokely added, "You know, Kristen Jean, those pictures, when I looked at those pictures, I knew I had seen her somewhere before." Router kept talking to Stokely throughout the afternoon, taking notes on the conversation. At one point she asked if Stokely still felt guilt about her involvement. "Of course," Stokely replied. "What do you think I have taken all these damn drugs for?" "If McDonald were convicted," Router asked, "do you think you could live with that guilt too?" "I don't think so." "Isn't there anything you could do to get rid of the guilt?" "Maybe sodium pentothal or hypnosis or something," Stokely said. The conversation was interrupted by the manager of the Journey's End, who called to say that Stokely was no longer welcome at the motel. A room was obtained for her at a nearby Hilton. Later in the afternoon, as Router and Stokely sat together in an automobile en route from one motel to the other, Stokely again said, "I still think I was there in that house that night." "Helena, is that a feeling you are having, or a memory?" Router asked. "It's a memory," Stokely said. "I remember standing at the couch, holding a candle, only, you know, it wasn't dripping wax, it was dripping blood." Punctual as always, Judge Dupree strode quickly into the courtroom Monday morning and immediately asked to see counsel for both sides at the bench. "Since court adjourned on Friday afternoon," he said, "I have spent a substantial portion of my waking hours researching and deciding the rather interesting evidentiary question which was posed, the question being whether statements by the witness Stokely should be admissible through other witnesses, statements made outside of court in far distant times. I will rule," he continued, "that these proposed statements do not comply with the trustworthy requisites of 804b3. In fact, far from being clearly corroborated and trustworthy, they are about as unclearly trustworthy, or clearly untrustworthy, let me say, as any statements that I have ever seen or heard. This witness, in her examination and cross-examination here in court, has been, to use the government counsel's terminology, all over the lot. The statements which he has made out of court were all over the lot also. So it can't really be said that the hearing of those statements would lead to any different conclusion than what the jurors got while she was here in open court. This testimony, I think, has no trustworthiness at all. Here you have a girl who, when she made the statements, was, in most instances, heavily drugged, if not hallucinating, and she has told us that herself. She has stated that in person. I think that this evidence would tend to confuse the issues, mislead the jury, cause undue delay, and be a waste of time. She has already told this jury everything that you proposed to show by these witnesses. And, Mr. Siegel, let me say that I did not reach this decision lightly. I spent roughly 7 hours on this thing on Saturday. I spent the entire day Sunday until 11:30 last night wrestling with this thing. And, as I do routinely in criminal cases, I lean over backwards to make sure that no criminal defendant is ever deprived of a defense. But I am thoroughly convinced in my own mind that your position is without merit with respect to this particular evidence. I have ruled on it, and as I say, I do not reach that lightly, because I am risking a terrible lot of judge time and juror time down the road if I make an error and it has to be retried. But I am confident of my position on this one. Even in the face of Dupree's decision, Bernie Siegel clutched at one final straw: the weekend's events involving Stokely and his assistant Wendy Rauter. Not only had Stokely implicated herself in the McDonald murders the day after they had occurred in 1970, she had done so again within the preceding 24 hours. Surely the jury was entitled to hear from Wendy Rauter about Stokely's remarks, and in particular, about her professed fear of testifying truthfully in open court. "I would ask the court," Siegel said, "to consider the circumstances under which these most recent statements were made. There is no indication of hysteria, no indication of drug abuse, no indication of anything other than the fact that these statements were made because they weighed heavily on the mind of this person. The statements were made of Ms. Stokely's initiative, and it seems to me that they so clearly reflect upon her state of mind that they ought to be heard again now. I think that if this testimony is heard, the jury would be in a far better position to make a determination as to evaluating Ms. Stokely's testimony, which we all struggled so hard to get. I think that all the instincts that surround this case cry out, let us know what Helena Stokely has said." It was Jim Blackburn who responded this time, repeating that, as Murtaugh had argued Friday afternoon, "Statements by Helena Stokely are not trustworthy. They simply are not credible. And I would also say to Your Honor, in regard to the question of reasonableness, she stated that the candle was dripping not wax, but dripping blood. Candles, of course, don't drip blood." "I don't know," Judge Dupree said. "With Helena, they may. I remain of the opinion," he continued, "that this Stokely girl is, I think, one of the most tragic figures that I have ever had appear in court. She is extremely paranoid about this particular thing, and what she tells here in court and what she tells witnesses or lawyers in a motel room simply cannot have attached to it any credibility at all, in my opinion. And incidentally, Mr. Siegel, I'm glad you mentioned it, because I had neglected to tell you, just completely overlooked it. But I want you to know that among others called by Helena, she called me twice on Saturday night, stating that she was living in mortal dread of physical harm by Bernard Siegel, counsel for the defendant, and that she wanted a lawyer to represent her. I think the jury has got as clear a picture of this particular witness as they will ever have, even if you brought in not just Friday's 6 witnesses, or your new one today, or even a whole wagon load of people, everybody that you ever talked to about this thing. I will exclude the evidence. Let the jury come in." And so the trial of Jeffrey McDonald continued, with the focus now, in the 6th week, shifting directly to the defendant himself. Chapter 4. On the evening before he was to testify, Jeffrey McDonald, as was his custom, ran 5 miles around the North Carolina State University track. Summer vacation was drawing to a close, and the NC State football team had already progressed to that stage of preseason practice in which physical contact had begun. McDonald joked that if the trial were to drag on much longer, he would have to treat his legal staff to season tickets to NC State football games. Bernie Siegel and Wade Smith were sitting in a small room waiting for McDonald. They had sent out for pizza an hour before, and the oil was now beginning to seep through the bottom of the cardboard box and to congeal on the tops of the lukewarm slices. "Close that door," Siegel said, once McDonald had entered the room. "Lock it. Put a Do Not Disturb sign on the door." This was, in Siegel's mind, the most important night of the summer, the most important night of the past 9 years, the night he prepared Jeffrey McDonald to testify. With McDonald already edgy and impatient, Siegel began to outline the tactic he intended to employ on direct examination. "Jeff, I know it is going to be extremely painful for you, but tomorrow I really want the jury to meet the victims. Tomorrow I'm going to bring Colette and Kimmy and Christy into that courtroom as living, breathing human beings. I've got the pictures, Jeff. I've got them from your mother. Pictures of the girls dressed up to go trick-or-treating on Halloween. A picture of Kimmy sitting on your lap while you were studying for a medical exam. A picture of the girls on the pony with you standing right alongside. A picture of Colette in the backyard, just outside 544 Castle Drive, repainting a piece of furniture. I'm going to show you those pictures tomorrow, Jeff. I've got them in slide form, and I'm going to show them on a screen so the jury will be able to see them too. I want the jury to see not only the pictures, but also to see you seeing them. And then, Jeff, I'm going to make you look at some of the crime scene photographs, some of what you saw in those first moments after the murders, some of what you've been trying to forget for 9 years. "Terrific, Bernie," McDonald said sarcastically. "Jesus Christ, why don't you just hire 4 people to club me and stab me while you're at it?" "Jeff, listen to me. You are the client. This is your life, not my life, at stake. If you really don't want to do it, I won't do it. But I need those pictures. I want that jury to see your family. I want them to see people, not just a collection of fibers and hairs and bloodstains. This case, Jeff, is unique. Normally you want the jury to forget the victims. You want to ignore them during the defense. Here our goal is just the opposite. We want them to go into that room to deliberate with one thought and one thought only on their minds. This man did that to those people? Jesus, Bernie. After 6 weeks of telling me the prosecution's case isn't worth shit, now it sounds like you're saying I've got to sit up there and prove my innocence." "No, no, no," Siegel said. "Don't misunderstand. I think we could rest right now and win. There is no case against you. There never was. There never will be. That is just as true now as it was the first day I said it. But I don't want that one holdout juror to make us go through all this again." "Which one?" McDonald said. "You mean the former state cop with that pinched mouth and nasty eyes? Or that accountant with the purple splotches on his hands who's been looking at me for 6 weeks like he's a member of the KKK and I'm a nigger he just caught molesting his daughter? Or do you mean that weepy woman in the first row who looks at Blackburn like she's praying he'll propose marriage to her every time he turns in her direction?" "Jeff, Jeff," Siegel said. "We have wound up with exactly the jury we want. Our system has worked. There is absolutely no question about it. I understand you're getting antsy. I understand it's been a long 6 weeks. But please, don't start second-guessing our judgment now. It won't do us any good, and it will only make the next few days even harder on yourself." "What do you mean now? I've been telling you this from the start. I said it the very first day. Those weren't jurors you were choosing. They were 12 nails for my coffin." "Listen, Jeff, we're not here tonight to talk about the jury. We're here to talk about you, and about what you're going to say tomorrow, and about the way in which I want you to say it. And it's exactly this attitude you're displaying right now, the sarcasm, the bitterness, the snide remarks, that I want to be sure the jury never gets to see. So get it out of your system tonight. That's fine. Sharpshoot us. Only you'd better not do it on the stand when Blackburn starts to cross-examine you. You don't have to be Laurence Olivier. You don't have to sell them a bill of goods. Just be yourself, and you'll be fine. But I want you to look past Blackburn. Look at the jury. They're the ones you're talking to, not him. Blackburn, MacDonald muttered. He's a chicken shit. He's got no guts at all. All right, Jeff. All right, Siegel said. The problem is, at the grand jury you came across as abrupt, cocky, chauvinistic, sarcastic, and callous about women. Here you have to be a little humble. If the jury sees that you're getting impatient with Blackburn, they might feel that you could also have been impatient with your children, and that is an impression that we certainly don't want them to develop. So what happens when he asks me why I went into the Green Berets? You don't want me to tell him it's because I love to strangle people with piano wire? No, Jeff, Siegel said patiently. I don't want you to talk about piano wire. And if he asks me if I've got any homosexual leanings, I'll say, well, I have been noticing your nice tight ass, Mr. Blackburn. Jeff, will you please listen? Siegel said. For one last time, for the sake of the rest of your life, you will have to be patient with a prosecutor who has never experienced the loss of his own wife and children. We all know there is a lot of pain here. All we're trying to get across is that it should not come out as anger. As I said to you in the letter I wrote you in June, you want to convey feelings that are appropriate to the occasion. Just focus on the jury. Forget Blackburn. Forget Freddie. Forget how much Murtaugh has gotten under your skin. Murtaugh is a turd. I hate him. Yes, Jeff, but letting everybody in the courtroom recognize that is not what you want to do. You can't afford to come across as arrogant, or as a homicidal psychopath, I suppose. Jeff, this is exactly what happened to the grand jury. The jury will not be sympathetic with someone who is overtly and consistently belligerent. That's how Warheide pissed all over you at the grand jury. Warheide, that Nazi. All right, Jeff. There's no point in belaboring this any further. I've known you for 9 years, and I know that you're smarter than you're acting right now. Just remember that you've got people on that jury who like you and who want to help you and who are charged up to help you. Tomorrow, you've just got to give them the ammunition. On direct exam, I'm warning you. I'm going to go straight for your emotions. I'm going to reduce you to a slobbering mess. I'm going to show you every picture you've never wanted to see. And I'm going to ask you every question that you've never wanted to answer. I'm going to leave you with the jury in the palm of your hand. And all I want to tell you, before you leave here right now, so that Wade and I can get to work on specifics, is that we want you to come out of the cross-exam sounding like the same person you were on direct. It's that consistency that will make you believable. You'll score no points with overt bitterness. Once you're acquitted, I don't care what kind of names you call anybody at the press conference on the front steps of the courthouse, but tomorrow, I implore you, for the sake of the rest of your life, don't be snotty. All right, MacDonald said, standing up. I appreciate all the advice, and I only have one piece of advice to give you about how to handle the direct examination. What's that? Siegel asked. Go easy on the pony, Bernie. After all those character witnesses, if they hear about that pony one more time, they're gonna puke. At 10:01 a.m. on Thursday, August 23rd, 1979, Jeffrey MacDonald took the witness stand. For 9.5 years, he had been telling his story to the military police at 544 Castle Drive in the early morning hours of February 17th, 1970, to ambulance drivers, orderlies and doctors at Womack Hospital, to Ron Harrison and to the CID and FBI later that morning, to his own mother and to Freddie and Mildred Kassab that afternoon, to Grebner, Shaw, and Ivory at CID headquarters on April 6, 1970, to the Philadelphia psychiatrist later that month, to the reporter from Newsday later that summer, to the Army psychiatrists at Walter Reed, to Colonel Rock at the closed Article 32 hearing, to Dick Cavett and a nationwide television audience shortly after his discharge from the Army, to Pruitt and Kearns in February and March of 1971, to the grand jury for a total of 6 days in August of 1974 and January of 1975, and in a hypnotist's office in Beverly Hills in early July. But this was the first time he had ever told it in public, under oath, and it was the time that could determine whether he would spend the rest of his life as a free man or as a prisoner. Dr. McDonald, Bernie Siegel began, "Where do you reside, please?" "In Huntington Beach, California." "Dr. McDonald," Siegel said softly, "are you married today?" "No," McDonald said, biting his lip and looking as if he were about to cry. "Is there some reason why you are not married?" With that, the sobs began to come from McDonald's throat. "I can't forget my wife and children," he managed to say. "Do you still have occasions to think about your family, even though it has been 9.5 years since they died?"
"Every day," he sobbed.
Siegel's tone and manner were that of a funeral director about to assist a grief-stricken widow to a limousine. "May I ask, Dr. McDonald," he said, appearing embarrassed by the necessity of speaking at all, "what are your strongest or most consistent memories of your wife, Colette?" Jeffrey McDonald, who had been through it so many times, for so long, had to make himself go through it one more time. He rubbed his eyes with his hand, as if wiping away tears, and he began to glance helplessly around the courtroom, as if hoping that someone could come and save him from all this. Then the sobs came again, preventing him from answering immediately. It was demeanor quite different from that which he'd last displayed in a Raleigh courtroom, when, at the end of his grand jury testimony, he had told Victor Warheide to shove all his fucking evidence right up his ass. "Excuse me," McDonald said, momentarily regaining his composure. "Colette was very beautiful and intelligent and warm. She was a great mother and wife. May I ask, Dr. McDonald, what are your strongest memories of your daughter Kimberly?" "Of her beauty and brightness," McDonald said. "She was very inquisitive, I think exceptionally bright, a delightful person, and very loving." "Can you share with us, please," Siegel continued, "what are your memories of your daughter Kristen?" "Well, she was the prettiest of all of us. She was a little ball of fire. She was a tomboy at 2.5, and she was very loving also." He covered his face with his hands, and his shoulders began to heave as sobbing sounds came from his throat. It was all that Bernie Siegel could have wanted. "What sort of things did you and your family, the four of you, including the children, what sort of things did you do together?" "We lived together," McDonald said. "We shared most everything. We had a good life. We were all friends. Colette and I shared the children growing up. We shared our life experience." It went on that way for almost 5 hours, not including the morning recess, the break for lunch, and the afternoon recess. Siegel had McDonald read the printed message in the Valentine card that Colette had given him from Kimberly and Kristen. "To a wonderful daddy. Dad, there are millions of daddies in the world, it's true, but the nicest by far is you." And he had McDonald read the Valentine card that Kimberly had made for him in school. "I'll trim my little Valentine with hearts and ribbons gay to tell you I love you today and every day." And he showed McDonald a series of enlarged photographs, visible also to the jury, and asked him to identify each one. "This is Colette and I when we were getting married. This is Colette and I when Colette was pregnant in Chicago. That's me with Kimberly as a baby in Princeton. That's Kimberly. That's Kimberly and I on a couch in Chicago. That's Colette playing with Kimmy. That's Kimmy and I studying for an examination in medical school. That's Christy, probably about 18 months old. That's Colette and I at my mom's home. That's Kimmy and I holding ice. I was playing in a football game the day before and had a bruise on my face, and Kimmy and I were both applying ice. That's Colette and Kim swimming. That's Colette and I at a Princeton football game. That's Kimmy and I at the Children's Zoo in Chicago. That's Kim and I playing at the beach. I was just covering her up with sand. That's Colette, Kim, and Christy. It is Christmas time. That is my family. About what year? Siegel asked. 1969. The last Christmas you and your family spent together?
Yes.
Finally, I want to show you this photograph, the last of the series. Tell us what it depicts and what you know about it.
That is Kim and Chris. Are the girls dressed up in some kind of costumes, Dr. McDonald?
Siegel asked, his own voice now seeming close to the breaking point. McDonald, sobbing again, was unable to answer. All he could do was nod.
Would that be Halloween of 1969?
Yes.
Do you see the clothing that Kristen McDonald is wearing?
Yes.
What is it, Dr. McDonald?
Pajamas, made up like a clown.
The same pajamas that she was wearing on the night of February 17, 1970?
Apparently so.
Your daughter Kimberly, is she wearing some kind of nightgown also?
Again appearing unable to speak, McDonald nodded.
Can you tell us what it reads across the top of the nightgown, please?
Little Angel, McDonald said,
and then he, Siegel, and a number of others in the courtroom, which was filled to capacity, began to cry openly. Among those who did not cry were Freddie and Mildred Kassab, who were seated in the front row. Grinning sardonically, Kassab shook his head from side to side and uttered the word faker loud enough so he could be heard across the aisle. During the course of the morning and afternoon, McDonald said at various times that Colette had been ecstatic at the news that he had decided to enlist in the Army. She thought it was great, that he had very much wanted their third child to be a boy because I thought it was fair that we had one boy, and that both he and Colette had felt that his proposed 30-day trip to Russia with the boxing team was an advantage and sort of a privilege and a good time and an honor. She was not reluctant in the least. Siegel did not question McDonald in detail about the apparent discrepancies between his account of February 17th and the physical evidence found inside the apartment. The government, like hounds to the fray, will leap at that tomorrow, he said later. It was not part of what I wanted to do. He did, however, elicit from his client the information that McDonald was not certain at all about the exact details of what had transpired. I have never been certain, McDonald said. I have never told anyone I was certain. It is extremely vague. There is a lot of confusing thoughts. There is a lot of sounds, and there's a lot of sights, and the recollection is hazy at best. Siegel made McDonald look at the crime scene photographs and asked him if they were an accurate representation of what he had seen. All I remember is a lot of blood, he said, looking at a colored picture of Colette's battered body on the floor. She looked bloodier than that to me. When shown similar pictures of each of his daughters, McDonald said, "That is Kimmy," and also identified Kristen, much as his neighbor, the warrant officer, had done 9.5 years before. "What did you do there, in Kristen's room?" Siegel asked, "on this second trip?"
"I only recall doing one thing."
McDonald, throughout the day, had never been far from tears, or at least from the appearance of them, and now he was, once again, on the edge.
"What was that?" Siegel asked softly.
"I patted her on the head and said she'd be okay."
His voice trailed off into a sob.
"I'm sorry," Siegel said. "I heard you say that you patted her on the head, but did not hear the words."
"He said she'd be okay," Franklin Dupree interjected sharply, glaring at Siegel with an expression of obvious distaste. Later, Siegel asked McDonald to describe what his life had been like following the dismissal of charges against him
and his honorable discharge from the Army. I don't really remember the last part of the month of December. It was kind of depressing with Christmas coming up. I was seeing friends, and friends were trying to see me, and we were also trying to reopen the investigation. We were making trips to Washington, D.C. I was having meetings with congressmen and senators and newspaper people and TV people. There were people trying to write a book about the case. It was a very confusing and depressing time. When you went to New York City, what were your plans for the future? What were you going to do with the rest of your life? Well, I was trying to figure that out. The plans that Colette and I had always had, you know, they were shattered. Well, what were the factors that caused you to give up the goal of taking a residency at Yale and going to California instead? There were a lot of reasons. I did not have the interest in becoming a great orthopedic surgeon teaching at Yale, because it was part of Colette and the kids, and that was our dream. And with part of it gone, it did not make much sense, but I had other reasons also. Well, I would like you to share those with us, please. The East Coast had become a very sad place for me. I was uncomfortable. My friends were very supportive, and yet I was uncomfortable receiving their support. No one really knew what to say, and I didn't know what to say. And it was constantly there because it was constantly in the press, and the reinvestigation was now beginning. How did you arrive at the decision to go to California? What were the key factors that helped you make that decision? Distance from Freddie. A new environment. Not so many people may be worried about my welfare, my emotional makeup, and constantly either, you know, trying to support me or to get me to do something like public appearances or to write a book or whatever. And I just, it was, once I arrived in California, I had this tremendous sense of relief. Now, when did you arrive in California? July 5th, 1971. Where did you start working at that time? St. Mary's Hospital in Long Beach. Where you still are employed today? That is correct. What kind of life did you build for yourself between July of 1971 and, say, January of 1975? Just tell us about the kind of life you created for yourself up until that juncture. Well, I was working very hard. I developed a good position at the hospital. I was active in community affairs. Our group was becoming prominent in the area in emergency medicine. We were teaching at USC and later UCLA. I bought a house on the water, not a house, but a small two-bedroom condo, which I still, that is where I live now. I bought a boat and lived on the water, working, I think, fairly hard. How many hours a week do you ordinarily work? 80? 70 or 80? Why do you choose to work that many hours, Dr. McDonald? It just seemed easier. Work was good for me. Easier than what? Easier than sitting and thinking? About what? My family. There was a pause as Jeffrey McDonald, apparently once again overcome by emotion, lapsed into silence. Bernie Siegel walked slowly toward a table on which lay a number of items which had been introduced into evidence. Dr. McDonald, he said, I want to show you the four instruments that we have come to hear so much about during this trial. The club, the bent-bladed knife, the straight knife, the ice pick. I want you to look at those weapons, please. And I want you to now hear me and respond, if you will, to what the indictment has said. Siegel began to read. In the first count, it is charged that on or about the 17th day of February 1970, at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, upon lands acquired for the use of the United States and under the exclusive jurisdiction thereof, and within the Eastern District of North Carolina, Jeffrey R. McDonald, with premeditation and malice aforethought, murdered Colette S. McDonald by means of striking her with a club and stabbing her, in violation of the provisions of Title 18, United States Code, Section 1111. Siegel stared at Jeffrey McDonald. Did you stab your wife? Did you club your wife? I did not. With those or any other weapons? I never struck Colette.
Dr. MacDonald, I want to read to you the second count of the same indictment and again ask you the same question. In that count, it is charged that on or about the 17th day of February 1970 at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, upon lands acquired for the use of the United States and under the exclusive jurisdiction thereof, and within the Eastern District of North Carolina, Jeffrey R. MacDonald, with premeditation and malice aforethought, murdered Kimberly K. MacDonald by means of striking her with a club and stabbing her, in violation of the provisions of Title 18, United States Code, Section 1111. Again, Siegel stared at MacDonald. Is that true? It is not true. I never harmed Kimberly. I will read you, Dr. MacDonald, the third count of the indictment and ask you to respond again. That on or about the 17th day of February, 1970, at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, upon lands acquired for the use of the United States and under the exclusive jurisdiction thereof, and within the Eastern District of North Carolina, Jeffrey R. MacDonald, with premeditation and malice aforethought, murdered Kristen J. MacDonald by means of stabbing her, in violation of the provisions of Title 18, United States Code, Section 1111. For the third time, the lawyer's eyes met those of his client. Is that true, Dr. MacDonald? It is not true. Taking a deep breath, Siegel approached the witness stand and handed Jeffrey MacDonald a piece of paper. Finally, Dr. MacDonald, I would like for you to share with us all a letter addressed to you dated August the 26th, 1969, from your wife in Patchogue, Long Island, to you at Columbus, Georgia. If you would be good enough to read that to us, sir. In a halting, stumbling voice, MacDonald began to read the last letter Colette had ever written him. Sunday night. Darling Jeff, what a difference a day makes, or even a few minutes, especially when you take me from the... His sobbing temporarily prevented him from continuing. Nadir of despair, and return me to that happy, full of love and life feeling. Thank you, sweetheart. You really know how to handle me. In case you're getting ready to jump out of an airplane and need a little material for pleasant daydreaming, here are a few of my favorites. 1. Remember the night you came to Skidmore in the snow for Happy Pappy Weekend and stayed in the Rip Van Dam, the fashionable watering place of the New York Jet Set. 2. The night we came home from Paul and Kathy's and we decided to have something to eat in the city and we went to Manana after walking around a bit. This is one of my favorites because I think we were definitely on the same wavelength that night. 3. When you were in the infirmary at Princeton because you had dropped the weights on your chest, you wrote me an abstract story entitled The Cool Guy and the Warm Girl. Do you remember that at all? I do. It was beautiful. 4. New Year's Eve this year. What could top that for a feeling of togetherness? 5. Cutting up onions and peppers together and planning for our giant champagne brunch, and then, of course, the brunch itself. 6. The first time you came to Skidmore and the picnic we had in the woods. 4 kisses. Colette. With trembling hands, Jeffrey MacDonald lowered the letter to his lap. He looked 5 years older than he had 5 hours earlier. He began to sob loudly, and as he did, Bernie Siegel's own eyes filled with tears. 3 members of the jury were weeping openly, and the sound of sniffling and sobbing could be heard from all portions of the courtroom, except the right front row, where Freddie and Mildred Kassab sat, dry-eyed, staring unflinchingly at MacDonald. The extended pause in the proceedings was punctuated by Freddie Kassab's short, sardonic laugh. Then Judge Dupree declared a recess until the morning. Chapter 5. In approaching the question of how to conduct his cross-examination, Jim Blackburn kept one principle uppermost in mind. He did not want the trial,
and eventual jury deliberation to turn into a referendum on whether Jeffrey McDonald was or was not a good guy, or whether he had contributed more or less to society than had Freddie Kassab. It had been a careful analysis.